This is Calliope Writing Coach, the podcast about writing and publishing success from every angle. I'm Angie Fenimore, international best-selling author and writing coach.
And I'm Michael Sheen, author, platform designer, and marketing master. Episode 27, I'd Give You My Kidney. Welcome, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Calliope Writing Coach Podcast. You got Michael and Angie in the house.
Hi.
And today's special guest is Mr. Harold Mintz. Welcome, Harold.
Thanks. Welcome back to you.
Excellent. So let me tell you a little bit about Harold. In his life, Harold has had two successful careers and one passion. Growing up with an architect as a father provided him with a front row seat watching someone successfully take a passion for creativity and develop it into a fulfilling occupation. This led to Harold's successful 25-year career in advertising and marketing. Then opportunity came knocking. Upon answering the door, he decided to shift gears and head to Los Angeles to work with childhood friend, Hollywood director, Tom Shadyac, best known for his films Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, Liar Liar, The Nutty Professor, Patch Adams, Bruce Almighty, and Angie and I's personal favorite, his documentary, I Am. If Harold's professional career has fed his financial needs, it's been his connection to the world of organ donation that has fed his soul. Back in 2000, Harold became one of the country's first altruistic organ donors, offering his left kidney to someone he'd never met. A short documentary on his donation, called 1-800-GIVE-US-YOUR-KIDNEY, recently completed a tour on the film festival circuit. Today, Harold continues to shine a light on organ donation awareness by speaking about his donation to schools and organizations around the country. Wow, welcome, Harold. This is so exciting to have you.
Oh, we're so excited to have you. This is so up our alley.
You know, I'm listening to you describe, you're reading that bio there, and every time I hear somebody talk about what I did, giving a kidney to, to a stranger, I hear it and it still sounds so outrageous to me, because who the hell does that? That's not what
But
sure enough, there I am.
It's a joke. Oh yeah, I'd give my left kidney. He'd give his left kidney.
Yeah.
Right?
It's kind of nutty.
So, obviously this decision didn't come just at the spur of the moment. Talk a little bit about what led you to even start asking questions about that.
Yeah, that is the question. So I get asked all the time, why would somebody, wake up one day and start giving out body parts to people they don't know? And to get down to it, that's not really what happens. Many, many breadcrumbs were placed on a scale for me that eventually had enough of them to where it tipped. And hindsight being what it is, I can actually go back in time and say, okay, I can see exactly what those breadcrumbs were that led me to that surgeon's table. And for me, that very first breadcrumb was high school. And I'm in class, I think it was math class. Teacher said, we're having an assembly today. And I don't know if you remember high school and the word assemblies, but for me, it was, that's great, because any kind of assembly, whatever the assembly was, was something that got you out of class. And so this particular one was held in they're normally in the gymnasium or the auditorium. This one was kind of in our cafeteria, which was kind of an odd place. So we get there and the doors swing open to the cafeteria. And instead of the normal tables and chairs that are set up in a cafeteria, there was beds or cots. And my classmates were laying down on tables. And I quickly noticed they were giving blood. So we all look at our teacher and go, okay, hang on. This is absolutely not an assembly. What the heck is going on?
It's an assembly of some kind.
He said, you don't have to do this. We were seniors, so we were old enough to be able to do it without parental permission. But he said, you can go back to study hall or you can try to give blood. So for the first time in my life, I gave blood that day. And it wasn't because Harold's a nice guy. It wasn't because, one day I'm going to give a kidney. It was literally for, three reasons. Number one, I'm not in math class. Number two, I got to lay down for 20 minutes, and I thought that sounded great. And last but certainly not least, was Donna Carter. Now, you're thinking to yourself, who the heck is Donna Carter? Donna Carter was the captain of cheerleaders when I was in high school, and she was there giving out cupcakes to everybody who gave blood that day. And I'm thinking, okay, laying down, no math, and baked goods from the captain of the cheerleaders. I'll give blood every day if somebody asks me to. This is
great advertising.
Perfect. And I, as I said, I look over my shoulder, hindsight, and go, I know very specifically that started a very long trail of breadcrumbs for me that I followed. And how does that even relate? Well, I know today statistics, and statistics say if you take a group of 100 people that have donated an organ, whether it's to a brother or a neighbor or someone they don't know, about 85% of those donors have given blood before. So it doesn't mean if you give blood, you're going to give an organ. But if you give an organ, there's a really good possibility that you're also a blood donor. And so without even realizing it, I started that path. And so there's a bunch of these little breadcrumbs that just started stacking up for me. And that was the first one. Reason number two was probably the biggest of all the reasons. I was a freshman in college, and I was home for Christmas break. I'm in the middle of three sons in my family. I have an older brother and a younger brother. And this is the first time we'd all been home for a while. It was Christmas break. I was at college. My older brother was at college. And here we are sitting around the dinner table for the first time in a few months. And my dad announces to the family he's sick. As a matter of fact, he says, don't worry, but they're going to take my gallbladder out on Tuesday. And I'm like, gallbladder? What the heck's a gallbladder? I don't even know what that is. He said, don't worry. It's they found some form of cancer, but in a huge majority of these cases, all they do is take out the gallbladder and everything is good.
Yeah.
So we go to the hospital on Tuesday, and making a long and relatively painful story short as possible, there was problems during the surgery. And by the time he survived it, although it was touch and go for a while, he lasted probably about 5 weeks after that. So from the minute he found out he had cancer to the day he passed was about 6 weeks. And that was kind of out of the blue for all of us.
Yeah.
And look, I saw the Lion King. I know the circle of life, and, you know, you're born, you have a family, hopefully you have a lot of friends, and you try to make that circle as big and wide as possible. But eventually all of our circles, you know, come to a close. We all get that. But, I remember sitting around afterwards, right after he passed, and talking to my brothers going, you know, we could have been the wealthiest people in the Washington, D.C. area where we lived, and it would have had absolutely no impact on the outcome. Why? Because whatever form of cancer he had, the doctors didn't know how to fix. It was just an unknown answer. Mm-hmm. As opposed to today, we're having this conversation. Today in the United States, 17 people are going to die from organ failure, where the doctors know exactly what to do to fix these people. It's not something they don't know. It's not something that they're experimenting with. They know exactly what to do to fix these people. They say, okay, Angie, you need a new kidney. They go to the shelf and then say, okay, Angie's an O positive. And then they find out, oh, sorry, Angie, we're out of O positive kidneys today. Come back next month. And you say, I don't have next month. I need it now. 17 times a day, people die waiting for these things. And when I heard that, I started putting together, I don't like the fact that we can lose somebody from, we don't know how to fix them, but losing a family member or a friend from something they know how to fix, they just don't have parts on the shelf. That was a big conflict for me. I had a hard time coming to terms with that. And as I said, no one wakes up and says, I'm going to give out body parts. But if enough of these little tidbits get stacked up, you all of a sudden, you don't see I'm going to do it. For me, it was, I started asking questions, and you got to be careful when you ask questions, because when you get answers that don't fit out, you know.
Yeah, we know that world.
So how about this one? I'm on a plane going cross country, and I'm reading a book. I finished the book, and there's still a few hours to go on the flight, and I was bored. So I put the headphones on and start watching the movie. And this is a number of years ago. We didn't have 20 choices to choose from. It was, you watch the movie that United Airlines tells you to watch.
Yeah.
And I put it on, and I realized, I think it was Debbie Reynolds played a grandmother, and her grandson was a high school football player. And the whole movie is, grandson has to decide whether or not he wants to continue to be the star of the football team or donate his left kidney to save grandma's life. Mm. And of course it's a movie, actually, it's based on true, but in the movie, he decides to push the pause button on football and save grandma's life. At the end of the movie, as the credits are rolling up, this is nutty, but starring, directed by, the very last thing on the screen said, for more information about organ donation, call this number. And I went, for whatever reason, I wasn't doing it. I wasn't thinking, you know, the end of the story, you know, I did this, but at the time it was just a thing on a screen. Mm-hmm. And I wrote that phone number down in the book that I had just finished reading and then put it away and forgot completely about it for 2 months until I cleaned out my briefcase. That book came out of my briefcase and I saw that phone number and I said, what the hell? It's just information. And I called up, and within 2 days, I got in the mail a huge packet of brochures and pamphlets all about how to donate. And as I'm looking through them, I realize every single one of those pamphlets is about how to donate after you're dead. Mm-hmm. So I call them back. I said, thanks, got all the information, not quite dead yet. Can you send me information about living donation? And they go, sorry, we must have misunderstood. Is it for a family member or a friend? And I went, well, it's actually none of the above. I'm just considering giving to whoever might need it the most here in the DC area. Mm-hmm. You're not going to believe what they said. They said, you're not allowed to do that today. That's illegal.
Really?
And I said, excuse me.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And they said, yeah. Have you ever heard of something called the waiting list? And I said, yeah, I think so. I said, well, it's run by the government. And when somebody, you know, pops up and needs an organ, they need a kidney or a liver or whatever it is they need, they go on this list. And that list is prioritized by the government by who needs it the most, which means how old you are, how sick you are, how long you've been on the list, this whole list of priorities. And when I said I was just considering giving it to whoever needed it the most in D.C. in my neighborhood, she said, what if somebody in Texas is next on the list? And you wanted to direct it to somebody in D.C., she said, it fights protocol. And so today you're not allowed to do that. Hmm. She said, but believe it or not, more and more people are starting to ask that question. So give this your name and number. And if anything ever changes, we'll call you. And I'm thinking, sure, sure you will. 2 years later, my phone rings and some lady says, is this the Harold Mintz who said he wanted to give his kidney away? And I went, whoa, slow down. I didn't say I want to do it. I just said I had questions about it. And she says, well, believe it or not, the very first community-based donor program has just been established in your – it's the first one in the country, and it happens to be in your backyard in D.C. If you're curious and interested, you can come in and ask questions. Holy crap, within a week, I made my appointment, and I went in with a checklist of questions. So let's flip the table for a minute, guys. Let's pretend you're going to give your kidney to somebody tomorrow. And I'm your doctor, and you can ask me anything you want to ask. They're going to cut you open and take out Lefty tomorrow. What do you want to ask? What do you want to know?
I want to know if it's if that will diminish my lifespan in any way.
That's the first question on my list. Actually, here's how I asked it. What are the chances that I'm not going to wake up from surgery, and what's going to happen to me if I do wake up? And they said, well, statistics say your life will be absolutely the same as if you had two. You remove one of your kidneys, which is like an extra. It's surplus. You remove one of them, and the other kidney that remains gets a little bit bigger, does absolutely the same work as the two of them did together, and you live happily ever after. There's no issues. And I said, wait a minute. So what happens if I want to drink a beer or have a glass of wine? They said, yeah, if you have too much alcohol, your liver won't love you, but your kidney has absolutely no problems with it. I said, what about fried foods? Yeah, your heart won't love you if you eat too much of that stuff. But again, your kidney's got no issues. And I said, well, I have to eat pills for the rest of my life. No, the recipient will have to have anti-rejection pills. But as a donor, once you're out of the hospital, bupkis, you don't need anything, nothing. Scars. And so at the time, this was 16 years ago, at the time they said there's two ways they do the surgery. Let's call the first way traditional. Now, the traditional way is they take like a scalpel and slice you halfway across your body. And they go in, they pull out your kidney and sew you back up. That takes probably about a week in the hospital and about a full month to recuperate. Mm. At the time, there was something new called laparoscopic surgery, which today they do a bunch of surgeries this way, where they just kind of go in and do it internally without major slicing. And that's a day and a half, maybe 2 days in the hospital, and you're back at work 2 weeks later if you choose to go. And so they said, when you walk down, you know, on the beach after the laparoscopic kidney removal, there's no bragging rights. Nobody sees scars. There's nothing to be seen. So that's what I ended up doing. But So I'm asking all these questions, and the lady said to me, well, thanks very much for coming. And I go, great. How'd I do? And she said, you did well. She said, now it's time for some of the medical tests. What do you think the very first medical test they did with me was?
Well, I've seen the documentary, so I know what the answer to that is. But
I'd say pee in a cup.
It's not pee in a jar, right? It's go see a psychiatrist, which just crack the hell.
That's great.
What kind of nut wakes up?
Yeah, because what human being is actually willing to step out of their own comfort zone, their own house, their own world? I mean, the world looks the way it does because, you know,
everybody kind of takes care of their own, don't they?
Right.
Well, sure. I mean, I laughed at it, but it sure made sense to me. As I told you at the beginning, I think it's nutty to do something like this, or it's out of the norm, let's call it.
Yeah, and so, that's what I'd call it. Not normal, which is great.
Yeah. And so I went and saw her, and it was just like in the movies. You're laying down on a couch, and I explained to her the same thing about cheerleaders and cupcakes and my father passing early and movies on planes. And when I'm done, have you ever been to a psychiatrist? I said, okay, how did I do? Did I pass? And she laughed at me and said, yeah, you did great. I'd like to see you next Friday with your wife. Oh, shoot.
We got to bring the boss this time.
Yeah, she knows nothing about this. This was just a curiosity for me. So that day I got home from work and my wife goes, how was your day, honey? It was good. You know, I had a meeting with Bob. You know, I had a hamburger for lunch. And oh, guess what I did this afternoon? I met with a psychiatrist to talk about maybe giving my kidney to a stranger. And she laughs. She goes, you're so funny. I said, I know, but I really did this. Now she stopped laughing so much. And she said, well, you're not serious, are you? And I go, well, I'm serious about asking the questions. Now she's definitely not laughing. And she says, well, you can't do that. And I said, now I get a little antsy. What do you mean I can't do that? She says, let me get this straight. You want to voluntarily raise your hand to volunteer your kidney to somebody you don't know, you've never met. Surgery you may not wake up from. Remember, you've got a wife, you've got a child. What happens if one of us needs the kidney in the future? You do not have my blessing to do this. And so now I respond, you know, with a little bit of anger in my voice, probably going, okay, wait a minute. You've always been smarter than me. Why would you say no to something you know nothing about? Why don't you come with me and ask the questions? And then I promise you, you can be 51% of this decision. I'll be 49. It'll be your call, but only after we collect the information. And I can't believe it. But she said, okay. So the next Friday, sure enough, she and I went to the psychiatrist's office. And I'm telling you, within the first 5 minutes, psychiatrist lady looks at my wife and asks the question. She says, in any surgery, there's risk. She said, there's a possibility that during surgery, there could be complications. And if that were to happen, and your husband, this is almost verbatim. She said, if your husband were left in a permanent vegetative state, would you still be able to take care of him for the rest of his life? Mm. And I'm looking at this lady going, really? Mm-hmm. That's the question you want to pop into my wife's head the first. We're trying to get her to say yes, and you hit her with the vegetable thing. And my wife, I love Susan. She's wonderful. She goes, look, I don't want to do this. I wouldn't do this, but I certainly understand what my husband's reasonings are for doing this. He's my husband. I love him. Of course I take care of him. Wow. Fast forward 45 minutes. We're putting our coats on, leaving the psychiatrist. And I walked out with a sheet of paper that is currently in my scrapbook that says, Harold is normal, and it has a fancy seal on it and everything. So I've got that going, which is cool. But after that, it was all the other medical tests, peeing and jugs and bleeding and MRIs and just all kinds of poking and prodding and looking in places you didn't know they were supposed to look. And the whole time I'm telling my wife, don't worry, there is no way in hell I'm going to pass all these tests. They had told me there was 10 people in line in front of me in this experimental program. And at the time, not a single one of those 10 people in front of me got past all the testing, you know, the psychological answers or medical reasons. Nobody got through. And I kept saying, don't worry, Sue, there's no way I'm passing these tests. Mm-hmm. Well, guess who the first person to pass the test in the country was? This guy. And so I went back to Miss 51%. I said, okay, you've gone through this for a few months with me. We've asked our questions. We've been approved. What do you think? And she said, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, great.
So in December of 2000, boom, I was on that surgeon's table.
Wow.
That's so great. You know, I looked into it, actually. There was a Facebook post that came through. Somebody needed a kidney. And I reached out, and my ex-husband shut me down real quick, by the way. So, you know, kudos to Susan, too, by the way.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a difficult decision to make, you know, on behalf of your partner. But wow, that is just amazing. You know, Harold, I want to change directions just a little bit with this.
Sure.
And our podcast focuses on writing and publishing from every direction. And while you haven't, I don't think you have written a book, have you?
Nope. I've got about 20 chapters on my computer that are just disjumbled and messed around.
Yeah, we gotta talk.
But, yeah. What you have done is you've told the story through the documentary. And what, you know, the thing that I'm seeing is that you have a very limited number of organs that you can donate and still be alive. I think kidney is the only one, isn't it?
No, believe it or not, you can give half your liver to somebody. And you're
okay.
Ready for this?
Okay.
Like a chameleon's tail, your liver will grow back.
Okay.
Yeah. And I know that, you know, your liver takes over for your gallbladder, because I've had my gallbladder removed, but nobody wants a gallbladder.
There's no market for gallbladders. But my point being is that you went through this, you experienced this, you had the surgery, and you affected the life of one person. But by telling your story, you are affecting thousands, if not millions, of people who then make the decision to, even if it's just something as simple as check that little box on their driver's license that say they'll be willing to donate their organs, right?
Or donate blood. You know, not maybe not everybody's willing to get on a table, you know, and donate a kidney. And it's so great there are people like you, right? But what a difference it would make if everybody checked that box, you know, organ donation.
Yeah. You know, if everybody checked that box, there would be nobody dying waiting on a list anywhere for organs. There'd be a plenty for, you know, for the pool that needs them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what you said is absolutely correct. There's lots of ways to help others. Telling the story, as I shared, is the way I know I ended up. I read a book, I saw a newspaper article, I saw a thing on news, and each one of those things at the time, they're insignificant events. They mm-hmm. really don't mean much until enough of them click. So by me sharing my story with you and others, you never know who's listening. You never know who's going to say, mm-hmm. I saw a Facebook post and it made me reach out to start asking questions. Donating blood, checking your driver's license is beautiful. You know what I have at home? It's crazy. I've got a folder on in my computer that are people that have reached out to me over the last 15 years who say they heard about the story. And because of that, not solely because of my story, but one of their breadcrumbs, they said, I read about you, and I ended up donating to my father, my wife, my neighbor. And I feel, holy shit. Can't believe that.
Yeah.
I can't believe that. I know that it was, I know how it happened. That's exactly what happened for me. But for them, for me to be a cog in their wheel, that's just beautiful. I think that's tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll keep me talking about it.
That's the real power of the sacrifice that you've given, is that, you know, if you just gave that sacrifice and then went back to your daily life, you would have affected one person.
But one person and her family.
One person
right.
and her family, mm-hmm. yeah. But by telling that story, and by promoting organ donation awareness, man, you have made such a difference. And what a platform to stand on is that, man, I gave my kidney. You could at least, you know, check the box on your driver's license, right?
Well, you got to be real careful with that. So here's a funny example. A few years ago, I asked my son, hey, have you checked the little box on your driver's license? No. Well, why not? Well, I don't want to do that. And that's cool. I always say yes, say no. Whatever your answer is perfect. As long as you've considered it, say yes or whatever you want to say.
Mm-hmm.
I said, can I ask why? Why you not check yes? And he said, it might hurt. I said, oh, I see. No, I'm not talking about what dad did giving now while you're alive. I'm saying after you're done with your parts, you know, after we pass, can they use it? And he said, no, I understood what you meant. It might hurt. And I laughed a little bit going, okay, so what you're saying is after you're dead and they start taking out organs for others, it might hurt? And he said, yeah. And it quickly made me realize there's no right answer here. Whatever you mm-hmm. decide, I'm telling you, I think the most important thing is to give it full consideration.
Right.
If you decide, no, that's not me, perfect answer. I love that. What bothers me, though, is the people who are at the DMV when they're filling out their driver's license application and just quickly go on to the next question because they want to get their picture taken or, you know, get their license without giving it full thought. So when I speak, oftentimes to high school sophomores who are about to get their license, I don't want to advocate for them to check yes. I advocate for them to consider it. Just think about it. Mm-hmm. And that at this point is probably good enough.
You know, there's research about checking boxes, and I can't recall. I don't recall what it was about. I think it was putting away money in a 401k. And here's what they discovered: is that the way the question was phrased on, you know, the forms that you fill out when you get hired was, "Do you want to check the box?" They rephrased the question and said, if you don't want to put money aside in your 401k, check the box. Really, no kidding. If they just reversed the question so that it says, check the box if you do not want to be an organ donor, I'll bet you we would see a huge spike in organ donors.
Yeah. In the organ donation world, that's called assumed consent. Mm. Let's assume they want to do that and make them tell us, no, we don't want to do that. And there are a few countries in Europe that do that, and they have, as you would expect, a higher percentage of people that donate afterwards. But there's a huge political pushback against that for some reason. I don't fully understand it, but I've heard people within the organ donation community say that'll never happen in the United States. That's, I'm not sure if it's a religious response, which doesn't make sense to me because every major religion blesses and approves of organ donation. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think Shinto, the Japanese Shinto religion, says no, you should be buried with all your parts go to mm-hmm. the next. But other than that, everybody thinks it's good. But assumed consent sounds great, but for some reason, there's a pushback against it. What do you think the percentage of people that check that box are? How many people check that
yeah,
box?
Yeah, I'm curious.
I would have no idea.
I mean, I'm an organ donor, I have actually the conversation with every one of my children as they're getting ready to drive. They're all organ donors by choice.
Most don't, but it's getting closer. It's 40% maybe that box, yes.
So even just to, you know, have that opportunity in such a ubiquitous fashion, you know, everybody has a driver's license or at least has the opportunity to apply for one. And, you know, right there, you've got that question right in front of you. Whereas I think for me to go out and seek it out, I probably wouldn't do that. But because it's as simple as checking that box when I apply for my driver's license, I've done it. And I think that many others have done that as well, just because it is so easy and accessible.
You know, and to allay the fears of anyone who's concerned about checking that box on your driver's license, the statistics that you have to die in a certain way in a certain place to even be able to donate. So if you are killed in a car accident out on Route 50, you can't donate. That's not how your body needs to kind of be alive in a hospital.
Right.
If they're looking for some term, you know, brain death or something where your body's still functioning, but your brain is no longer acting. So the stats are for every 200 people that check that box on their driver's license, only one of those 200 will be an eligible organ donor. Mm-hmm. So it used to be motorcycle accidents were one of the top contributors to the organ donor pool. It has since been superseded by, you know what the number one reason or physical ailment is? Opioid addiction, opioid overdose. Oh, people die from drugs where their bodies are still going, but their brain is gone.
Right.
But I've always said, I can't think of anything. You know, if somebody's going to die, nothing good comes from that except two things. One, stopping pain. If somebody's in pain that'll never be able to be stopped, it's time. Or B, if you can donate your parts after somebody passes or his or her parts, then wonderful. That's about the only two things good coming mm-hmm. from death in my opinion.
I would think that a fear that people face when they're actually, I'm talking about people who are considering checking the box, right? Would be, you know, what if I'm on that table, I'm in a coma, you know, they determine that I'm brain dead and I come back. You know what I mean? What if I'm really not quite done with those parts? That question.
Yeah, that's the number one fear why people will give, why they don't check the box.
I would guess. Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't usually happen. I mean, I guess it can happen, and it probably has, considering there's been billions of people, you know, who've had surgeries. But if you check that box and you're being taken to the hospital and they don't rifle through your wallet and say, hey, this one's an organ donor.
That's right, unless you're Nurse Jackie. She does that, you know. Of course, that's fiction.
On a fiction television show, yes. So let's change gears again, and I want to talk a little bit about your association and friendship with Tom Shadyac.
He's as much of a nut as I am.
Yeah, no kidding. He is incredible. Now, how long did you work with Tom?
I worked with him for only about 8 years, but we grew up together. We went to high school together. We were class clowns in Falls Church, Virginia. As a matter of fact, when we first met, we realized we made each other laugh. And because of that, we started doing the morning announcements together, the joke of the day over the morning announcements. And that grew over the years into, look, he does the heavy lifting. He's the more creative of the two of us by far, but he'll show me something and then I can't do anything when the page is blank. But if you give me a script, I can look at it and go, well, this is hilarious. Tweak it here, you know? So he does most of the work and it worked out well, but I've only worked with him for about 8 years. The conversation he and I jump into all the time is, yeah, Harold's the guy who gave away his kidney, but Tom's the guy who's opened up his wallet and is giving away his money.
Yeah.
And I call him a nut for doing that. And he calls me, you know, more magnanimous than he is. And we kind of have very interesting conversation about which is harder to do, body parts or wallet.
So are you still working with Tom then?
There's a new movie that he's working on that's being shot in Memphis, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Memphis, Tennessee is big with Tom and his family. His dad helped found St. Jude Children's Research Hospital with Danny Thomas 60 years ago.
Oh, really?
And so Tom's family would often go to Memphis in support of the hospital and various things. When Tom's dad passed a number of years ago, Tom's older brother, Rick, took over. And he actually runs, he's the CEO of ALSAC, which is the fundraising arm for St. Jude. Anyway, so Tom's new movie being shot in Memphis, Tom for 2 years has been trying to get my wife and I to move from Malibu to Memphis. And I always laugh and go, look, getting us to go from D.C. to Malibu, that's a shift. That's cross country. But that's not as drastic as moving from Malibu to Memphis. And so if I was 20 or 30 years old, yeah, I may very well have asked my wife to let's try this new adventure. Mm-hmm. But I'm approaching 60 and I wouldn't ask my wife to do that. And so because of that, that's where the work is. That's where the movie and the philanthropic work is taking place right now. I put a notice and took a step back from Shady Acres about a month ago, actually. It's still brand new. But you know, I talk to him kind of every day, every other day. I'm still doing a lot of the script reading or the ideas and the philanthropic concepts and things like that. So I don't work directly with him anymore, but it doesn't seem to have changed our partnership.
Now, when did you start working for him in his career? Was he still making movies, you know, the comedy genre? Was he still making those movies at that point? I mean, were you able to see the transition between that and the documentary that he made, I Am?
Yeah, I've seen the transition at first person, but no, I was not working with him when he did his Hollywood blockbuster movies.
Okay.
I joined him as a co-worker employee with Shady Acres Entertainment as he was just starting thinking about I Am.
Okay.
We were walking on, as a matter of fact, it was the Evan Almighty premiere. Tom used to invite a handful of friends from back home to come out for his red carpet premieres, which is tremendous. It gave us a chance to dip our toes in Hollywood and kind of see our friend, you know, in front of TV cameras, and we thought it was hilarious. Mm-hmm. But he invited us out for the Evan Almighty premiere a number of years ago. And as we were walking on the Venice Beach boardwalk, he said to me, what's wrong with the world? Which is a very Tom kind of question. And I quickly answered without thinking about it, we're all pretty selfish. And he said, well, how can you think we're all selfish when you gave away, you know, a body part? And that led to a 2-year conversation which culminated in me joining him in Malibu. We sold our house and moved into a trailer park here in Malibu, California, to work not only on I Am, but to work on Tom's working in many philanthropic projects. And together I was able to work with him, helping feed people and house people and other interesting, odd, but heartwarming stories. He does this every day without anybody noticing it. So.
Absolutely incredible. And to our listeners, if you have not seen the documentary I Am, stop what you're doing right now.
Well, not right now. Wait until the end of the podcast. Yeah. Okay. And then do it. And we're going to, we'll put a link. We'll put a link in the show notes for you. Okay. Incredible film.
And we became associated with it. We were on the committee that put on the Parliament of the World's Religions here in Salt Lake City. And Angie was the programmer for the film festival there. And
yeah, we went on the hunt for 11 films that were life-changing and that really fostered expanded context, seeing the world newly. And I Am was at the top of my list.
Yeah. And as part of that experience, a lot of the filmmakers were able to fly out and be a part of the event. Tom was and still is incredibly busy and wasn't able to fly out, but he did Skype in. And we put him in front of an audience of, I don't know, 300, 400, 500 people.
Something like that. Wasn't he on a layover in Denver?
He was like somewhere in an airport or something, wasn't he?
It was. And, you know, it's funny. Tom, with all the, he's made, I think the box office on his Hollywood movies was over $2 billion. And, but he could walk through an airport prior to I Am and nobody would know who they were sitting next to on an airplane. Once I Am came out, and it was available, you know, on Netflix or Amazon or all the other places that you could see it. Yeah. Then he became, he wasn't a Jim Carrey star, but he was recognized everywhere he went, everywhere he'd go. Oh, thanks for making I Am. So the number one movie he hears about is Ace Ventura, followed very closely these days by I Am.
Interesting.
So, a lot of people have seen it.
Well, and I think if I had a career like Tom's, I would definitely want to be remembered for I Am.
Alrighty then.
Not that there's anything wrong with any of the movies that he made prior to that, but man, what a difference.
Yeah, and it's touched people. I mean, people don't just come up and say thanks. They say thanks and let me tell you how that's affected my life.
Exactly.
And every single one of those stories, Tom feels it's beautiful. Beautiful.
Which is exactly what, you know, happens when you give your kidney to a stranger. It's like, yes, you do make a difference for that stranger and for that person's circle, but the difference that you're making, Harold, for other people to look, to just take a look and maybe check a box, you know?
Yeah, look, you know, let's even make it wider and more accessible to everybody. So some people are hearing this and they're going, yeah, that's not for me. You can make such a difference in people's lives by doing the smallest things. Mm-hmm. So Tom and I are walking down the streets of New York City a few years ago. Maybe it's 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. It's dark out. We're about two blocks from our hotel, and I see coming up on the right, on the sidewalk, is a homeless person bundled up with a coat and a hat, and I can't see much more of that. The closer we get, I see it's a woman. And now, Tom, I've seen do this a lot of times. He'll reach into his wallet and hand some money to a homeless person. But this particular time, he reached into his wallet and I saw he put a bill in his hand, but instead of just dropping it into a hat, what Tom does, he stops, he kneels down, he looks this woman in the face, introduces himself and proceeds to have a maybe no more than a 5-minute conversation. He didn't see a homeless person. He saw this particular woman looking her in the eyes and having a conversation. It seems like nothing, but as we're walking away, I couldn't stop thinking about that simple conversation, that smile, that hello, that eye contact could have had massive differences to that, you know, made a big difference to that person. It's so by saying hi to somebody or thank you to somebody is just, it can be just as important as a kidney or a $20 tip on a $5 bill.
Exactly.
The simplest of things can have the biggest impacts. You just have to notice. Really.
That's incredible.
So I just want to talk about energy and how it works. And because this is all part of this. This is all part of what Tom does when he stops and doesn't just drop a bill in a hat, but connects with another human being. Because I know there are people out there listening thinking, okay, yeah, philanthropist, great, whatever, right? So here's how it applies to every human being. It is the motion of energy that creates health. So you can look at this in a human body, blood flow stops, air stops moving in and out, right? Oxygen exchange stops. That body is no longer alive as an entity, right? Becomes food for other things. If you look at the world, you know, and you look at rivers and you look at bodies of water, energy in, energy out creates life in that body of water. Now, that body of water can do other things, you know, minerals come out of it, but really a fish can't survive in that body of water. It's the same thing with money. We even call it currency. You know, what's going on in the planet where we have so many millions, billions of people in need is that it's not that there isn't enough. It's that there isn't the flow of these things that sustain life, because some people have a whole lot and, you know, so it doesn't create that flow. And, you know, a way that you can see this is in exercise in particular. When you exert energy, the thing that you would expect would be to have less energy, but then you wake up the next day with more energy. So what we do as human beings is we're consumers, right? We, you know, shovel it in and then we it out. Okay. That's kind of what we do. So if you can just like see this circle that I'm like doing with my finger, like big circle, energy in my mouth, out, you know, like that. That's how human beings tend to function. But if we reverse that flow and instead give first, what happens is you create space for energy to accumulate. So, you know, Michael and I, we do writing for healing. It's actually got a name. It's called
Bibliotherapy.
Thank you. Bibliotherapy at addiction recovery centers. And this is just something we do. We give our time, right? This is something we teach these people. And what happens is when they get their stories out and they start putting them on the page, they create space for healing. And we've seen this so many times that, you know, I mean, we've been,
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I should do an experiment someday. But I've never seen anybody that didn't heal from getting that out. So the point is giving, finding ways to give, even if you're not up for needles or chick in a box, there are other things.
Laparoscopic or otherwise, right?
There's so much to do in the world. There's so much. And it doesn't have to be big and huge and, you know, lofty at all. What you do for yourself is that you actually expand your own ability to experience joy.
It's easy to talk about, but putting that in practice sometimes is changing the way, you know, some people are not born or raised, but you go to your natural instincts. I do what makes me feel good. Some people feel good when they buy clothes. Some people feel good when they eat food. Mm-hmm. I know what my most passionate things are, and this I think I tripped into it accidentally, but I've found that working in this organ donation community is a passion for me. I've got to do it. I can't not do it. So what you said makes sense, but if it's not in you, can you be trained to do that? Can you be taught to do that? Can you exercise that part of your brain so it becomes a part of who you are? If so, we should be working on that. But
Agreed.
Well, Harold, we are certainly grateful for what you have given your life to and the difference that you've made in the world. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for everything that you've done, you know, specifically to the organ donation community. And for us today, I think that you have, you've definitely expanded my views and man, you are a gift. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, that's a good place to start where we ended up and end up where we started. Thanks for having me on. As I know, someone's hearing this and it's affecting change, and that's good. And if anybody wants, forgive the plug here, but if anyone wants to see it's a short 16-minute documentary on my donation, they can go to haroldskidney.com, and it's there for free for everyone to see.
Oh, and it's great. And we're posting that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, we'll include that in the show notes. And is there any social media outlets that you participate in that we can give people links to?
My mustache turned 40 years old last year, and my very calm wife let me throw a birthday party for my mustache. So my mustache has its own Instagram page. It's I love this. It's Harold's Hair, H-A-I-R, Harold's Hair Old. Get it? Hair old for
I
you.
Get it.
Anyway, that's just fun. But no, other than that, no.
Well, I'm definitely going to follow your Instagram, your mustache's Instagram page, Harold. Thank you again so much for being here, and thank you for what you've given your life to. It has been an honor.
Thanks, guys. It's fun talking with you.
Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to subscribe so that you get each new episode as it comes out. You can find all of our episodes and show notes at CalliopePodcast.com. Don't forget to shoot some stars our way if you like the show.
Hey, I'm glad you're still here. I wanted to take just a second to tell you what we've been working on. You know, we've talked a lot about our live courses on the podcast before, and, you know, they are incredible, but it's not always possible to make it to a live course. So for the last year, Angie and I have been working hard to package what we teach in our live courses into an online course that you can participate in from anywhere. The Submission Possible series is a 12-part course that covers everything you need to write, edit, and market your story. There really is nothing like it out there, and we would love for you to check it out. In fact, we want to give you session one for free. Now, there's a link on our website at calliopewritingcoach.com. Just click on the yellow banner there and keep writing.